The visual arts are filled with figures and episodes from the Hebrew Bible. Why were artists and patrons, Jewish and Christian, so interested in the Hebrew Bible? What encouraged them to use it as a wellspring of artistic themes and visual imagery? Could the artistic legacy of the Hebrew Bible help us understand aspects of the Hebrew Bible more richly, more deeply? These episodes revolve around profound moments of fulfillment through transformation. Artists recognized the Hebrew Bible as a means through which they could expand the vocabulary and expression of their medium. They reveal fundamental truths about the covenants between God and man, about the challenges we face as divinely created beings in a fraught human world, and about the struggles and evil we face to ensure our liberty and survival. Such was and is the power of art. Welcome back to the artistic legacy of the Hebrew Bible. I'm Jacob Weiss. You've all heard the expression, a picture is worth a thousand words. We tend to use this adage to express how seeing an image can elucidate something for us more immediately and effectively than just reading a text. Whereas a painting or photograph can be beheld to some degree instantaneously, reading or speaking takes time, protracting and thus dulling or watering down the experience. And whereas well-chosen words may come close to describing the character of an expression or idea, an image, the adage suggests, does so in the truest and most direct way. But what if there are different, perhaps even conflicting, ideas at work? Aren't words better at communicating them? What if there is a dramatic change in the course of a narrative, or a sudden shift of emotion or perspective? How can a fixed, singular, and stable image deliver the necessary waves of information for us to perceive these dynamic changes? And what if the words that describe a sequence of events or a cluster of ideas are in themselves part of or essential to the story? How can an image represent something whose meaning is channeled primarily through words or verbal description? These are some of the questions that the artistic legacy of the Hebrew Bible helps us explore. An episode that posed one of the greatest challenges to artists and that by extension offered them a rich opportunity to define the creative independence of their medium is Moses with the Ten Commandments, which will be the focus of this discussion. Compared to the episodes of the Binding of Isaac and Jacob wrestling with the angel, the story of Moses with the Ten Commandments is inherently more complicated and more diffuse. Whereas the episodes of the Akedah and the struggle between Jacob and the angel are wholly contained within larger chapters and are strikingly succinct, the former episode taking up all of 19 verses, the latter but 11, the narrative account from when Moses first ascends Mount Sinai to receive the Torah and the Ten Commandments, to Moses' descent and presenting of the Ten Commandments to the Israelites, extends over 16 chapters in the book of Genesis. There are, of course, distinct parts of this narrative that could and did form the basis for artistic representation. In some contexts, they were depicted altogether. For instance, in one of the fresco paintings produced for the first decorative campaign of the Sistine Chapel by the artist Cosimo Roselli, he represents within one image different parts of the story of Moses receiving the Ten Commandments from the chapters of Exodus. In the upper part of the composition, Moses receives the tables from God on Mount Sinai. The sleeping youth oriented below Moses is Joshua, who, according to the text in chapter 24, accompanies Moses to the mountain, but does not ascend there with him. In the foreground at left, Moses and Joshua present the tables of law to the people. while in the center foreground, Moses is shown throwing down the Ten Commandments after discovering that the Israelites have fashioned a golden idol in the form of a calf, to which the Israelites are shown in devotion at right. On a hillside landscape in the upper right of the composition, the worshipers are shown being reprimanded and punished. In the context of the Sistine Chapel, which was conceived by and built by Pope Sixtus IV between 1473 and 1481 to serve as the private chapel of the Pope and his ecclesiastical court, the Sistine Chapel, of course, is also known today as the site of the papal conclave, the process through which a new pope is selected. The figure of Moses plays an especially important role. As a prophet, lawgiver, and leader of the Israelites, who, under God's hand, takes them out of slavery in Egypt to freedom in the Promised Land, Moses was considered within Christian theology as both a precursor of Jesus and a model of the Pope's role as intercessor on behalf of followers of the Church. As a visual expression of this relationship, six large-scale fresco paintings representing scenes from the life of Moses are oriented on the chapel's southern wall. Rosselli's depiction of Moses with the tables of the law is the fourth work in this sequence from the right. Facing these paintings, on the chapel's northern wall, are six identically sized fresco paintings based on episodes from the life of Jesus, each paired iconographically with the painting situated directly across from them. Facing Moses and the tables of the law is Rosselli's depiction of the Sermon on the Mount, in which Jesus expressed both the need to keep and fulfill the Ten Commandments, but also the distinction he drew between the laws as established by Moses in the Hebrew Bible and those he claimed to be establishing on a higher plane through Christianity. Among the artists who executed these 12 monumental fresco paintings were Sandro Botticelli, Domenico Ghirlandaio, and the aforementioned Rosselli, who were all brought from Florence to undertake the work. This is still about three decades before Michelangelo came to Rome from Florence. The Moses-Jesus typology, through which events in Moses' life are interpreted as precursors or prophecies of those in Jesus's, was already so well established by the Renaissance period that the parallels and points of contrast between the complementary sets of paintings on opposite walls of the chapel would have been read as a visual demonstration of the transition from the old law to the new. Moses's pervasiveness in the Hebrew Bible makes him inherently difficult and daunting to represent. He is, of course, the human character who takes up the most narrative space in the Hebrew Bible. The story of Moses' life fills up four of the five books of the Torah, Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, and Numbers. He continues to be referenced throughout the Hebrew Bible and is the prophet most often cited in the New Testament. His multifaceted role as prophet, leader, and lawgiver, moreover, are complemented and made even more difficult to characterize by his complexity. He is a prophet who does not live to see the vision of his prophecy in the Holy Land. He is a leader for whom leadership does not come naturally and whose followers are often revolting against his authority. He is a flawed human lawgiver who is tasked with recording divine, natural laws and instituting them into the community of the Israelites and their descendants. Moses' multi-layered external roles are complemented by his internal complexity and the unresolved or ambivalent ways he assumes these roles and reacts to God's commands. How did artists represent Moses' multifaceted character? How and in what ways did they channel his ambivalence and internal conflicts? Which episodes and parts of episodes were depicted with greater frequency, regularity, and consistency? How were his reception and conveyance of the Torah and the Ten Commandments, how did they come to be represented in art? Were there differences between how this role was depicted within Jewish and Christian contexts? How did this central episode in the Hebrew Bible spark artistic innovation and creative invention? In our discussion of the early visual history of the binding of Isaac, we explored how the representation of the Akedah on the Torah niche in the sanctuary of the 3rd century synagogue of Dura-Europis creatively interpolates elements like the figure of Sarah into the episode to amplify the symbolic meaning of the narrative. Juxtaposed with motifs from the Jerusalem temple on the other side of the frame over the Torah niche, the story of the binding of Isaac would have evoked for viewers the thematic parallel between the biblical narrative and the recent history of the temple's destruction. Echoing the story's symbolism within Jewish liturgy, it also expressed the hope for and our longing for a return to Jerusalem and the site of the Akedah. Such creative symbolic interpretation was central to the visual program at Dura, which paid particular attention to the figure of Moses and to his historical, theological, and liturgical role. Moses is depicted more frequently than any other figure in the wall paintings of Dura-Europis. To the right of the Torah niche is the rescue of baby Moses, one of the 4 scenes in the lower register of the sanctuary's western wall that feature children at different stages of life, from babyhood to early adulthood. This has led one scholar to name it the Children Register, suggesting that since its paintings were physically closer to and more easily visible by children, it was conceived specifically to appeal to and to educate the youngest members of the community. A painting of the Exodus from Egypt dominates the uppermost register of the Western Wall, with the figure of Moses represented 3 times as the sequence of the narrative unfolds from right to left. Moses is shown considerably larger than any of the other figures in the composition. It represents Moses, staff raised high, leading the armed Israelites out of Egypt. Moses appears again at the left edge of the sea, his staff stretched out over the waters, which is filled with the drowned Egyptians. And finally, Moses is seen again to the left, his staff touching the fish-filled sea that is parted, with the Israelites marching through in clearly defined lines. The prominence of Moses in the Exodus narrative, appealing multiple times in the paintings and in dramatically enlarged hierarchical scale, indicates that Moses loomed large, literally and figuratively, for the Jewish community at Dura. 2 large open-palmed hands are represented emerging from the upper margins of the composition, identified with the celestial realm, each angled towards the representation of the sea where the miraculous events are taking place. They are symbols of the hand of God, reinforcing the important idea in biblical and Jewish interpretive tradition that God generates miracles, that Moses was not himself the initiator or the source of the Exodus as a whole, but was only the representative of God's power. Indeed, there are at least 10 appearances of the hand of God in the wall paintings at Dura-Europis, reinforcing this idea and reflecting the abbreviatedly anthropomorphic conception of God that prevailed in Judaism in late antiquity. Still, the dominance of Moses within the Exodus scene and his conspicuousness on the western wall of the sanctuary suggests that the people who conceived the synagogue's decorative program sought to give prominence to Moses' life. They rejected the approach adopted in the Passover Haggadah, in which Moses is barely mentioned. The Exodus panel itself incorporates an Aramaic caption, as did other of Dura's paintings, that reinforces Moses' role. It reads, "Moses, when he went out of Egypt and parted the sea." Could this have been an attempt, a corrective, on the part of the Dura community, not just to acknowledge, but to celebrate the role of Moses? Did this visual program reflect a belief in the value that the example of Moses offered for the Eastern frontier community of the Roman Empire? did the figure of Moses echo for the community members the military power and political role of the Roman emperor, who would have been a common touchstone for Dura's citizens? But the most striking aspect of Moses' representation within the visual program of Dura's sanctuary are the four vertically painted panels that appear immediately above and slightly to the left and right of the Torah niche. Distinct from the mainly horizontally oriented narrative scenes covering the rest of the sanctuary walls, these panels depict single bearded male standing figures oriented frontally and looking out towards the viewer. The most clearly identifiable subject is the panel at the upper right, which represents Moses and the burning bush. Moses appears here with his right arm outstretched, extended towards and overlapping the burning bush that is shown along the left edge of the composition. The flames engulfing but not consuming the bush are suggested by the series of spiral waves interspersed among the leaves, and in the original painting, they are purplish in color. In compliance with God's command to take off your sandals from your feet, for the place you are standing on is holy ground, Moses has taken off his shoes, depicted here as simple lace-up boots, the kind worn by farmers in the ancient world. Reinforcing God's rule in the narrative and presence through the burning bush, the hand of God is shown emerging from the left-hand upper corner of the composition, directly above the bush. As in the Exodus scenes, the hand appears as an extension of an arm stretching forth from the celestial heavens. The subjects of the three other vertical panels would have been read in order from right to left, following the direction of Hebrew or Aramaic. The panel at the upper left represents Moses receiving the tablets of law, which follows chronologically after Moses and the burning bush. Different identifications have been made for the two lowermost vertical panels, but one widely shared proposal is that they also represent the figure of Moses, only in different narrative settings, with the panel at the lower right representing Moses reading the law, and the panel at the lower left, and the final one in the sequence of four, representing Moses ascending to heaven. All four of the images of Moses relate to narrative episodes in the Hebrew Bible, but are decidedly unnarrative in their format. The figure of Moses stands alone, taking up much of the space of the panel. Aside from the attributes that accompany him, the burning bush, for instance, there is little extraneous detail to draw out the story. Moses is oriented formally towards the congregation, and seems to function symbolically through his roles as prophet or lawgiver, perhaps even more so than he does as part of the story that is illustrated. In the context of the Torah arc, the images would have represented objects of reverence, echoing the function Moses had within Judaism and the liturgical devotional setting of the synagogue. The panel of Moses receiving the tablets of the law, the subject would later often be referred to as Moses with the Ten Commandments, is especially telling, for it distills the story of Moses' time on Mount Sinai and his receiving of the Torah and the Ten Commandments into a single representative image. Unfortunately, the painting is greatly damaged, but enough of the lower portion of the composition is preserved to recognize its narrative context. And by comparing the work to other similarly oriented images, including later ones that have similar religious and narrative contexts, one can infer the general character of the composition. From the lower part of the composition, one can see that Moses has removed his sandals, echoing and visually mirroring the composition of Moses and the burning bush. The undulating landscape that curves and rises dramatically at the right edge of the composition suggests that the figure is standing on or on the edge of a mountain. Since neither of the figure's arms and hands are visible, one can imagine that they are reaching up and to the right, the direction in which the figure of Moses is facing in order to receive the tablets of law from God. The deep red background behind the figure of Moses could be intended to evoke the state of Mount Sinai, which, on the verge of Moses' ascendancy to receive God's commands, is described as all in smoke because the Lord had come down on it in fire, and its smoke went up like the smoke from a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly. Later mosaics and paintings that seem to have been based on the two upper vertical panels at Dura Europus help us fill in and better understand the rest of the heavily damaged composition. There is a very close parallel between this pair of images at Dura and the pair of mosaics over the apse in the basilica at the monastery at Mount Sinai, which date to the 6th century and were commissioned during the latter part of the reign of the Byzantine Emperor Justinian. In the Sinai mosaics, the scene of Moses at the burning bush appears at the left, and that of Moses receiving the Ten Commandments is at right. This reverse orientation of the two scenes from how they are oriented at Dura makes sense considering that Greek and Coptic-speaking members of the monastery read from left to right. The mosaic of Moses receiving the tablets of law at this monastery of St. Catherine shows Moses standing barefoot, oriented to the left, with his arms reaching up to receive the tablets, though his hands are covered by the antique style cloak he wears. The hand of God, emerging from a celestial cloud in the upper left corner of the composition, delivers them to Moses. The outcroppings of rocks to Moses' left and right indicate that he is at the top of the mountain. It seems very likely that the representation of Moses receiving the tablets of law on the western wall above and to the left of the Torah niche at Dura would have had similar elements in its composition. The outstretched hand of God, as it is seen at St. Catherine's Monastery, is compatible with how it was depicted in the Dura wall paintings. One can imagine how inspiring it would have been for the congregants at Dura to behold the scenes of divine revelation through the burning bush, of the receiving of the tablets of law, and of Moses reading the law in the context of the liturgy and ceremony of the synagogue. Positioning these panels directly next to the Torah Ark would have communicated the clear idea that the Torah that was being kept, read, and revered in the synagogue was the same text that had been entrusted to Moses and the Israelites in the Hebrew biblical account. The image of Moses receiving the tablets of law would have echoed for congregants the passage from Exodus at the very end of chapter 31 that reads, "And he gave Moses, when he had finished speaking to him on Mount Sinai, the two tablets of the covenant, tablets of stone, written by the finger of God." Inscriptions at Dura tell us that the Torah Ark was referred to as Beit Arona, literally, House of the Ark, emphasizing the direct connection that was maintained between the Dura Ark and the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant was depicted repeatedly in the Dura wall paintings, further echoing its presence. Thus, we recognize in the Dura paintings, and especially those centered around the Torah Ark, an interest in consolidating the connection between their ritual Jewish practice and their Hebrew biblical roots and ceremonial traditions. Returning to the 15th century fresco painting by Cosimo Rosselli that we began with, it's striking to note that the part of the story that the artist gives central focus and thematic prominence to is not that of Moses receiving the Ten Commandments, but of Moses in the process of shattering them on the ground. Although Rosselli presents the process here sequentially, as it were, with Moses shown about to throw one of the tablets down in his right hand, while the other one is still in his left hand, waiting its turn. Indeed, it was only in the emerging and expanding context of Christian basilicas and churches that artists turn their attention away from the image of Moses receiving the Ten Commandments in the upper reaches of Mount Sinai to that of Moses destroying them before the Israelites upon his descent from the mountain. The account in the Hebrew Bible describes, of course, two sets of commandments that were received by Moses from God. The destruction of the first set is described in Exodus chapter 32, immediately after Moses invokes God not to let his anger flare up against the people for their disobedience. And Moses turned and came down the mountain, with the two tablets of the covenant in his hand, written on both their sides. On the one side and on the other they were written. And the tablets, God's doing they were, and the writing, God's writing it was, inscribed on the tablets. And Joshua heard the sound of the people as it shouted, and he said to Moses, a sound of war in the camp, and he said, not the sound of crying out in triumph, and not the sound of crying out in defeat, a sound of crying out I hear. And it happened that when he drew near the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing. And Moses' wrath flared, and he flung the tablets from his hand and smashed them at the bottom of the mountain. And he took the calf that they had made and burned it in fire and ground it fine and scattered it over the water and made the Israelites drink it. It is only after, let's just call it, some difficult and delicately navigated negotiation that, two chapters further on, God says to Moses, carve you two stone tablets like the first ones, and I shall write on the tablets the words which were on the first tablets that you smashed. The first set of tablets had been composed entirely by God and given to Moses. Now, following, and perhaps taking some liberty with how the commentator Rashi characterizes this passage, God says to Moses, you smashed the first set, now you carve this one. This is followed later in the same chapter by the second point at which Moses descends from Sinai to present the Israelites with the Ten Commandments. These, as the text several times reiterates, formed in part in Moses' own hand. And the Lord said to Moses, write you these words, for according to these words, I have sealed a covenant with you and with Israel. And he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. Bread he did not eat, nor water did he drink. And he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the 10 words. And it happened when Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the covenant in Moses' hand when he came down from the mountain, that Moses did not know that the skin of his face had glowed when he spoke with him. And Aaron and all the Israelites saw Moses, and look, the skin of his face glowed, and they were afraid to come near him. And Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the chiefs in the community came back to him, and Moses spoke to them. And afterward, all the Israelites drew near, and he charged them with what the Lord had spoken with him on Mount Sinai. Now, there are many different interpretations of why the Hebrew Bible describes two episodes of Moses receiving the Ten Commandments from God, with the first set being destroyed before the second set can be realized. But Jewish interpretive tradition generally understands this two-stage narrative holistically and efficaciously. In other words, that it reflects a natural and morally revealing aspect of the path through which we interact with and receive God's commands. A common perspective found in Hebrew biblical commentary identifies a necessary progression or improvement from the first set of tablets to the second, and thus an inherent logic in the way the story plays out. The first set of commandments were produced entirely by God alone. The tablets, God's doing they were, and the writing, God's writing it was, inscribed on the tablets. A characteristic that made them, according to Midrashic literature, inherently out of reach or unrealizable in the human world. The second set of commandments were produced in partnership between the people, represented by Moses, and God. And he, Moses, wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the 10 words. In Midrashic literature, the first tablets were seen as the work of heaven, the second tablets, the work of man. This made them more reflective of the covenant between God and man, and thus more viable and durable than something given by God alone. In at least one Talmudic tractate, a discussion about the differences between the first and second versions of the commandments leads to the suggestion that the second tablets have a more superior text because they were meant to last. Meaning and significance were attached to the indirect, wayward, and extended Hebrew biblical account of the Decalogue. Rather than seeing Moses' smashing of the tablets as an aberration that derailed God's plan, Jewish tradition understands it as a first stage in the acknowledgement and reception of God's commandments, one that recognizes human limitations and sets into relief the ultimate value of what was received in the second stage. Christian theology and, more importantly for the purposes of our discussion, the art that derived its themes and perspectives from Christian theology, read the story of the receiving of the Ten Commandments very differently. They portrayed Moses' shattering of the tablets not as a prelude to the ultimate reception of God's commands, and certainly not as a means to set into relief the more meaningful character of the commandments the Israelites ultimately received, but rather as a standalone episode, one that revealed something meaningful about Hebraic law and Judaism as a whole. By focusing only on the image of Moses' destruction of the tablets, Christian artists plant the idea that Judaism, that is, the old law, is ultimately to be superseded by Christianity, the new law. Christian artists reinforce the idea that the destruction of the first set of tablets was not so much an abortive misstep on the way to a higher plane, but revealed something inherently flawed in the enterprise of Jewish lawgiving and in the lawgiver, who is characterized as impaired and blemished. One of the ways they did so was depict Moses with horns. There are different theories about the origins of this motif, many tracing it back to the first substantial popular Latin translation of the Hebrew Bible, the 4th century Vulgate of St. Jerome. In Jerome's translation, which became the core of the authorized Catholic edition of the Hebrew Bible, there is a jarring break in meaning from the textual description of Moses upon coming down from Mount Sinai. The verses in the original text read, "Moses did not know that the skin of his face had glowed when he spoke with him, and Aaron and all the Israelites saw Moses, and look, the skin of his face glowed, and they were afraid to come near him." Jerome translated these verses as, "And Moses knew not that his face was horned from the conversation of the Lord. And Aaron and the children of Israel, seeing the face of Moses horned, were afraid to come near," thus removing the idea that Moses' face emits a divine radiance and evoking something, well, something very different. Much debate has revolved around the intention of Jerome's translation and subsequent mistranslations of the Hebrew phrase karan or panav, the skin of his face glowed, to his face was horned. Some suggest that it evoked for Jerome the positive divine associations with horns within the antique world. Others recognize in it a misunderstanding, an innocent misunderstanding, of the rare Hebrew biblical verb karan, while still others see in it a more sinister and coordinated attempt on the part of Christian adapters to eliminate any sense of Moses's glorious effulgence or even to generate an anti-Semitic portrait of a false prophet. Visual representations of a horned Moses do not appear until some 7 centuries after Jerome's translation, when the motif is found in English manuscript illuminations of the mid-11th century. Such images, as has been proposed by one art historian, were adapted or migrated from virulently anti-Semitic dramas and forms of street theater sponsored by the church, which featured Moses in a horned headdress. By the middle of the 13th century, when William de Braille, a manuscript illuminator from Warwickshire, England, painted this full-page miniature of the Israelites worshiping the golden calf and Moses breaking the tablets, the motif of a horned Moses had become common in English manuscripts. So conventional is the representation of Moses as horned in this artistic context that he is represented this way in scenes from the same manuscript, such as the 7th plague of Egypt, Hail, which take place chronologically before Moses' encounter with the divine at Sinai, from which the motif of the horns ostensibly emerges. The French inscription at the bottom of the page featuring Moses breaking the tablets draws attention to the anger that prompted Moses to destroy the first set of tablets. The inscription reads, "When Moses went to the mountain to receive the law, God said to him, 'Go down, your people sin.' Moses descended and saw his people adoring a calf, which they made of gold and silver. When he saw this, he grew angry at them and hurled his tablets against the rock so that they broke." However one characterizes the motivation of early translators of the Hebrew Bible, it's clear that depictions of Moses within late medieval art conveyed, and not so subtly conveyed, the idea that Moses was literally marked by non-human features, and that by extension, these features revealed an inner bestial or feral character. Why would such a characterization of Moses have resonated in a Christian context, or what was it intended to project for viewers? In part, it seems, that Moses' anger and his act of decalogicide, if I can use such a term, were not aberrational, but part and parcel of Moses' animalistic being, fated to doom the reception of God's laws and commandments, and to derail the arrival of the true law until the arrival of Jesus and the inception of Christianity. Jewish interpretive tradition understands the mechanics of Moses' anger and destructive act in a dramatically different way. Some sources focus on the ways Moses' anger and impulse to destroy the first set of tablets were not only justified, but helped set the Israelites back on the right path by, in essence, allowing them to recognize the error of their ways. Psalm 106 voices praise for Moses' actions. "They made a calf at Horeb and bowed to a molten image, and he would have wiped them out were it not for Moses, his chosen one. He stood in the breach before him to turn back his wrath from destruction." In related ways, other sources downplay the anger that flared from Moses, suggesting that the act of destroying the first set of tablets was deliberate, calculated, or premeditated, or even, for the most part, God's own doing. Although most Talmudic sages are critical or disparaging of Moses' anger, there is at least one line of argument that excuses or even congratulates Moses for his anger, portraying his shattering of the tablets as one of several things that Moses did on his own initiative and that God ultimately approved of after the dust had settled. Moses is envisioned here as a rogue but praiseworthy rabbi who recognizes the Israelites as unworthy recipients of receiving God's first set of commandments. Through this destructive act, they are set on the right path and ultimately redeemed. Artists depicted the horned transformed Moses in other contexts as well, suggesting a kind of institutionalization of this motif. A prominently horned Moses appears looking up at the burning bush in a 13th century stained glass window at the Chartres Cathedral, one of the few Gothic cathedrals whose original windows are relatively well preserved. This is another example, by the way, of the motif being used in an episode whose occurrence in the Hebrew Bible precedes that which inspired the invention of the horns. By the time of the Renaissance, when the art of large-scale, freestanding figural sculpture had been revived, Moses' horns had effectively been shaven down to become rounded, rough protuberances. They were characterized so by the great Dutch sculptor Claus Sluter, who worked as court sculptor for Philip the Bold, Duke of Burgundy. It was for Philip that Sluter and his workshop carved his monumental Well of Moses, featuring a horned Moses holding the tablets of the law. In the context of the Duke's burial site at the Carthusian monastery Chartreuse de Champmol, Moses, among five other Hebrew biblical figures arrayed around a central hexagonal structure, served to represent the prophecy of Jesus' crucifixion and incarnation that was read by Christians into the Hebrew Bible. Moses' anger served as rich inspiration for the greatest sculptor of the Italian Renaissance, Michelangelo, who was summoned to Rome by Pope Julius II, not to paint the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel discussed earlier, but to design and create the Pope's tomb. Like the tombs of Egyptian pharaohs, papal tombs were often conceived from the very beginning of the office holder's inauguration. As the Pope's final resting place, the tomb served to personify and aggrandize elements of their ecclesiastical reign, and to represent and secure the Pope's service within the line of popes dating back to St. Peter, one of Jesus's 12 apostles, whom Catholic tradition accredits as being the very first pope. There was no greater honor or boon to an artist's career for a sculptor than to be commissioned for such a project. Michelangelo, having recently completed his monumental sculpture of David for the city of Florence, came to Rome in 1505, 2 years after the beginning of Julius II's reign, to begin work on his tomb. The project was conceived at such an unprecedentedly grand scale, and the negotiations around it were so fraught between the patron and artist, that it was left unfinished when Julius II died in 1513. This is one of the preliminary drawings by Michelangelo, which provides only a partial sense of the ambitiousness of the project. It was only completed, much reduced from its original conception, some 22 years later. One of the three figural sculptures executed by Michelangelo by the time of Julius's death, from among the 25 or so originally conceived, is the figure of Moses. It is now on display in the Basilica of St. Peter in Chains as part of a papal wall monument, while Julius II is actually interred in St. Peter's Basilica, where the tomb was intended to be. One can perhaps get a sense of the intensity and frustration Michelangelo exhibited around this commission, at least from the sense of one of his contemporaries. In Raphael's School of Athens fresco, which was completed around 1511 for a neighboring room of the Sistine Chapel, a presumed portrait of Michelangelo, writing and brooding while leaning on an uncarved block of marble, appears in the foreground. Though displayed in its ultimate setting at ground level, flanked by sculptures of the Hebrew biblical sisters Rachel and Leah, these were executed by one of Michelangelo's pupils, The figure of Moses was originally intended to be positioned on an upper story, and so seen from below, as one half of a complementary pair of biblical figures, together with St. Paul, one of the many figures that was never executed. As an apostle who lived after Jesus' death, Paul is credited with having founded several Christian communities in Europe and Asia Minor, and having been a major contributor to the New Testament, thus spreading Jesus' teachings and Christianity in the mid-first century. Within the overall program of the tomb, Moses and Paul were intended to represent not only the worlds of the Old and New Law through their associations with the Hebrew Bible and New Testament, but also to symbolize the active and contemplative lives. This followed from a traditional hierarchy, which had contemplation, that is, Paul, triumphing over action, that is, Moses. Indeed, in the eventually realized scheme of the wall monument, the figures of Leah and Rachel serve as replacement allegories of the active and contemplative lives, with Leah, Jacob's first wife and childbearer of seven children, representing action in the Christian imagination, and Rachel, Jacob's second wife and his long unrealized love, representing ideal contemplation. For Michelangelo, one of his most daunting challenges was, how do you have the seated figure of Moses, because in such an ambitious multi-level structure, the key figures could not be represented standing, come across as a manifestation of the active life? In short, how do you render an inert sculpture of a seated figure that exudes the energy and ideal of action? Michelangelo understood well and took inspiration from the character of the Hebrew biblical story of Moses, as well as the legacy of how Moses was interpreted in Christian theology and art. Moses is represented with the two tablets of the Ten Commandments under his right hand, sandwiched between his forearm and the right side of his body, and he is horned. These attributes, the tablets and the horns, confirm that the figure is Moses. But Michelangelo does not rely on the signaling role of these motifs as the basis for his subject. This is far from a symbolic or iconic depiction. Indeed, he has generated a dramatic narrative within the marble sculpture. Moses, in fact, does not sit still. He is physically active. His head is turned more than 45 degrees to the right, indicating that his seated posture has been disrupted. The irises of his eyes are oriented, moreover, at the extreme right of his eyes, generating the sense that his glance has trained itself on its target somewhat abruptly. He is staring fixedly at something specific. His constricted brow and the tensed muscles of his face echo this sense of alarm, or is it rising anger? Other parts of the figure suggest a similar, parallel sense of disquiet. The fingers of his right hand are not wrapped around and do not even touch the tablets. They are splayed and intertwined into the waves of hair in the figure's thick and twisted beard. This striking passage in the sculpture further enhances the sense that Moses' attention has been dramatically redirected from the Decalogue that rests under his arm, somewhat absent-mindedly perhaps, to what Moses is staring at in completely the opposite direction. Moses' muscular limbs, prominently veined skin, and distinctly chiseled features suggest not a figure at rest, but one in an agitated state, about to jump into action. The modeling of drapery in the sculpture suggests the forms of muscles and nerves that are in the process of firing underneath. The position of Moses' legs and the orientation of the figure's feet down to the toes create a corresponding impression of impending movement. The foot of Moses' right leg is planted firmly on the ground plane, oriented in the direction in front of the figure. Moses' left leg, however, is splayed acutely towards the back of the figure and twisted to the right side. The figure's left knee is dramatically bent, and the foot of this leg is oriented at an angle towards the ground plane. The toes, especially the big and second toes, are bent from pressing against the ground, suggesting that they are beginning to take the pressure of the figure's body as it shifts its weight, rolling onto the ball of the foot, as a figure would do if he were to push off the ground in the process of standing up. As an avid and sensitive student of Greek and Roman antique sculpture, and a keen observer of live models and dissected corpses, Michelangelo generated effects to simulate, as it were, the impression that the figure of Moses is getting ready or even in the process of standing up. Combining the figure's legs in the process of motion, its overall bodily tension, the acute orientation of the head to the right, and the intense glare in the direction of something outside of the frame of the sculpted figure in space, Michelangelo conveys the impression of a drama unfolding. Moses is about to rise up in anger upon seeing the Israelites dancing around the golden calf and is going to fling the tablets from his hand, smashing them at the bottom of Mount Sinai. Intended to be positioned on an upper story of the tomb monument, such an impression would have been strengthened, enhancing for viewers the sense that they beheld Moses from below as he descended from the mountain. Michelangelo used a similar technique in his earlier monumental sculpture of David, which, like the Moses sculpture, is conceived to depict a moment prior to the explosive action. Unlike most of the earlier sculptural and painted depictions of Moses and Goliath, a subject that was especially favored in Renaissance Florence, Michelangelo's David is portrayed not after defeating and decapitating Goliath, but at a point prior to the battle. David has his eyes set on his enemy, who is seen somewhere to David's left. Like the Israelites dancing around the golden calf, Goliath's presence is implied outside the space defined by the frame of the marble sculpture. David's furrowed brow, directed glare, and tensed muscles and veins suggest a transition is about to take place. From David's composed and balanced posture to an active David who, with the stone in his hand and the slingshot draped over his left shoulder, will fight Goliath, disrupting the equanimity in his form. In similar fashion, Moses looks off to his left, as if in the process of taking in something that is happening outside of the frame of the sculpture. But whereas David appears still and perfectly balanced with the potential to engage his enemy at any moment, Moses is already in the process of shifting his weight to stand up and destroy the tablets. He is in a state of external and internal disruption. Like the extended multi-stage Hebrew biblical narrative, Michelangelo's Moses reveals where Moses has come from and received, what he is beholding and experiencing, and what he is about to do. In this sense, the marble might be thought of as the sculptural equivalent of the picture that's worth a thousand words. It flouts the natural expectation that a sculpture, especially one that is almost 8 feet high by almost 7 feet wide, depict a stationary figure and a single moment in time. Moses seems to bring us along through the story, with the physical and emotional character of the figure implying what is happening and about to happen. The idea and challenge of making sculpture that shuns conventional wisdom and that strives to achieve what one would only expect to find in other media, like prose, poetry, and even painting, is something that was of great interest to Michelangelo. In the early 16th century, Italian artists and theoreticians of art developed and debated a concept known as paragone, or the ideal, applying it towards the goal of finding the ideal form of art. More specifically, paragone came to express a kind of comparative enterprise, whereby the merits and deficiencies of distinct techniques and art medium were identified and evaluated. In the competitive environment of the Italian Renaissance, this resulted in an especially fierce and revealing debate between painting and sculpture, with representatives of the respective media weighing in on behalf of their chosen approach. In rhetorical terms, the debate was often waged by describing the greater challenges one faced in generating artistic expression and achievement in one's own medium. But perhaps the greatest of compliments was if one could achieve in one's preferred medium effects that were typically thought of as naturally suited to or easier in a different medium. Michelangelo's Moses is a masterclass in the art of paragone, achieving in marble sculpture what would be thought of as belonging or naturally suited to the realms of painting or biblical narrative. One of Michelangelo's greatest champions was Giorgio Vasari, a younger contemporary of Michelangelo's, an artist and architect in his own right, and Michelangelo's first biographer. In describing his Moses sculpture, Vasari writes, "Moses rests one arm upon the tablets he is holding in one hand, and with the other, he grasps his long and flowing beard, which is executed so well in the marble that the hairs so difficult to render in sculpture are delicately carved, downy and soft, and drawn out in such a way that it seems as if the iron chisel must have become a brush." Vasari here is engaging himself in the art of paragone, drawing attention to the ways this sculpture overcomes its inherent limitations to create virtuosic effects that legitimately belong in the realm of painting. It was the biblical story and account of Exodus that inspired Michelangelo to conceive of such a physically and emotionally virtuosic figure. In the wake of the Counter-Reformation, the Church issued guidelines for the making of religious art, among them that subjects should be depicted with clarity and legibility, and that they should prompt piety in viewers, that is, that they should be used to convey church doctrine and ideals, and that it should have the power to communicate and drive home its teaching in unambiguous ways. The painting of Moses breaking the tablets of law by the Italian 17th century artist Guido Reni, who was frequently commissioned to paint altarpieces and other religious works for churches in Rome, Naples, and Bologna, reflects such demands. Moses here is depicted under the full impact of his emotions, his mouth wide open, his face contorted in rage, while he seems to be in the process of throwing one of the two tablets to the ground. Meanwhile, the figure's twisted folds of red drapery, the sky filled with heavy gray clouds and strong contrasts of light and shadow, seem to echo and dramatize Moses' actions. It is not surprising that a very different understanding of Moses and the Ten Commandments was reflected in the art of the Protestant Netherlands. As some have convincingly argued, the painting by Rembrandt van Rijn of Moses and the Ten Commandments from late in the artist's career depicts Moses not with the first set of tablets, about to throw them to the ground in anger, as is more traditionally thought, but rather Moses and the second set of tablets in the act of presenting them to Aaron and the people of Israel. Rembrandt's is not the angry prophet, but the intermediary on behalf of the Israelites who is physically worn. He had been without food or water for 40 days and nights, and spiritually radiant. He was unaware that his face had glowed from speaking with God. Like Rembrandt's painting of Jacob wrestling with the angel, which we discussed in our last session, this work adopts a strikingly close-up view. Like the figure of Jacob, Moses is visible from just below the waist up. We, the viewers, are brought into the immediate realm of the figure's surrounding space. Even more notable is the background in both paintings. The figures of Moses and of Jacob and the angel are silhouetted against murky natural backdrops made up of brown, orange, and dark gray. The colors and forms evoke some sense of landscape. There are large rocks in the immediate lower foreground next to the figures and an indication of dark clouds in the upper background, but they reflect an indistinct style, as if Rembrandt was aiming to evoke a landscape without specifically describing it. This approach is reflective, to some degree, of the rough painting style that the artist adopted late in his career. By 1659, around the time when both of these works were painted, Rembrandt's eyesight had deteriorated, and there is a general tendency in his late work to blur the outlines between forms, to make use of darker, less multichromatic color schemes, and to enlarge the scale of forms and bring them closer to the picture plane. In the case of the Jacob painting, we discussed how the indistinct background seems to suggest that the wrestling match is taking place in a kind of dreamscape, reflecting ways the episode is interpreted as taking place in Jacob's imagination. Indeed, the compositional and thematic similarities between the two paintings and their common Hebrew biblical provenance has led one critic to suggest that the two works were conceived by Rembrandt as a pair, possibly for a Jewish patron. In Rembrandt's depiction of Moses, there is an even greater lack of distinction between the form and colors with which the prophet is represented and those with which the background is described. Moses appears to blend into his surroundings, to merge with the rocks around him. This feature led one writer to describe Moses as the figure of prophet coarsely clad, rough cast, as though extruded from stone himself. As Mayer Soloveitchik has pointed out, this evokes a distinct aspect of the story of the second set of tablets that Moses received at Sinai, one that we touched on earlier. Moses was a passive bystander in receiving the first set of tablets. Nothing in him changed, and thus he was not physically transformed. For the second set of tablets, Moses was a true participant. He had a role in bringing the tablets to life, in carving them into being. The Hebrew Bible informs us that he actually carved the stone on which the words were to be engraved. And that is why the process literally and figuratively transforms his appearance, made him a different person, and by extension, the Israelites a different people. The blending of the figure of Moses with the background stones around him offers a visual metaphor for this idea and for the way the second set of commandments provide a lasting and transformative legacy. The artistic legacy of the story of Moses and the Ten Commandments in the modern era varies dramatically depending on the context in which an image appears and the ideals of the artist who conceives of the image. In the 19th century, especially in America and Western countries, representations of the Ten Commandments were frequently commissioned for courthouses and government buildings, reflections of the ethos that guided liberal society in the modern era. This large-scale painting of Moses descending with the tablets of the law, it's about 21 feet wide by about 12 feet high, by John Rogers Herbert, was commissioned as a mural for England's House of Lords in London. It took Herbert, who was a popular illustrator and portraitist in Victorian Britain, more than 15 years of work, including trips to the Middle East to study the people and setting there so that he could achieve what he considered archaeological accuracy. Reflecting the popularity of the subject, Herbert fashioned two copies after his House of Lords mural. One quarter-size version now in Hamburg, Germany, and this scale version purchased by the National Gallery of Melbourne in Australia in 1878, the largest and most expensive painting the gallery ever acquired. The first trustees of the gallery saw art as a means to raise the moral and aesthetic sensibilities of colonial Melbourne's growing citizenry. Moses bringing the Ten Commandments to the Israelites, this is, as in Rembrandt's case, the second set, was a model for the institution of justice in modern society. Bringing divine law down to the people served as a potent metaphor for the process through which courts, governments, judges, and leaders would wield and apply foundational ideals in the real world. A little over a century later, in 1966, Marc Chagall painted this depiction of Moses receiving the tablets of the law at St. Paul de Vence in France. Echoing the representation of Moses painted on the wall of the synagogue at Dura Europis and the mosaic installed at the monastery of St. Catherine in Egypt some 14 to 1700 years earlier, Chagall depicts the reception of the Ten Commandments from a pair of disembodied hands, disembodied divine hands, emerging from the heavenly clouds. Here, the artist is uninterested in archaeological accuracy. Chagall and most of his 20th century artist contemporaries would suggest that such an enterprise was futile and unwarranted. Chagall's Moses, rays of light, not horns, emanating from his head, is, like the Moses from Dura, significantly larger than any of the figures of the Israelites represented below. Portrayed monochromatically and delineated with sharp black outlines, he floats upwards towards the tablets, in the opposite direction from Herbert's Moses. He is silhouetted against planes of fiery yellow, suggesting perhaps for Chagall the aspirational and spiritual enterprise of reimagining Moses' story in the contemporary world. As we'll discover next time when we explore the episode of Queen Esther appearing before King Ahasuerus from Megillat Esther or the Scroll of Esther, artists took great interest in Hebrew biblical stories beyond the five books of Moses. In the case of the Esther Scroll, Jewish tradition smiled upon the inclusion of imagery and decoration alongside the text, unlike the restrictions placed on Torah scrolls. Artists and patrons far removed from the Jewish ritual celebration of Purim, on which the Book of Esther is traditionally recited aloud, were also greatly inspired by the story and its interpretive legacy. They recognized in Esther, in her plight, and in her courageous appearance before the Persian king in order to save her people, rich opportunities for expressing their own cultural values and artistic ideals. Looking forward to seeing you then.